And so what you're getting today, happy Pentecost, a week late. Because you're getting my Pentecost sermon today. So I hope a week late is not too late to talk a little bit about Pentecost. I told the congregations over there comment that I've heard a couple times, I think, from individuals in this conversation, congregation, that would say something like, well, I didn't know where you were going in that sermon, but you got there. And like I said, I never knew exactly what that meant. You know, were they excited about that great conclusion, or were they excited about how I finished? So anyway, hopefully I will get there for this Pentecost sermon. Actually, in a way, is not exactly something new to you, because is that what that noise is coming from?
I think so.
Sounds a little better. There's a little of that thumping noise. Is my heart beating because I'm so excited about coming here and speaking to y'all. But I did give you part one of a sermon the last time I spoke, and you might have forgotten a little bit about what that was about. So I will remind you, I was talking about three keys to self-motivation in my last sermon. One was to understand how to set goals, which we covered in some detail. The second was to understand how to prioritize tasks, which we also covered. But I did not get to the third one, at least not very much, to understand how to make choices about what is best, the best path. And that's really where I was going in preparing these sermons. The whole idea of this proposition, that many of our most important decisions are attempts to forecast the future. And the idea being that every time you make a decision, you're really basing that decision on what you think will happen in the future if you make that decision. And usually when you're making choices about something, you got choice A, you got choice B, and you're thinking, okay, if I make choice A, I predict this will happen. If I make choice B, I predict this will happen. Which of those things do I want to happen, or do they both lead to the same? Which one is most likely to get there? See, we're in the predictor business. Not so much the prophecy business, but in predicting our own futures through the choices that we make today. And so that was the title of last sermon. It was part one. This is expectations for the future and choices for today. Part two. Now, basically, we want to focus in on choices, decision making, the tools that you can use, how we make decisions, and what does this have to do with Pentecost? Well, one thing that a general area of making good decisions that, and I'm going to kind of relate science to the Bible today. I'm going to talk about what psychologists, sociologists have learned from doing all these neat kind of experiments they always do to figure out how humans think and how the brain operates and that sort of thing. And kind of look at, does that really match up with what the Bible teaches? So that's kind of where I'm going here and started that in this last sermon. But, you know, how do we manage the complexity of choices? Now, choices are not so easy. Sometimes it's just a gut feeling. Okay, I'll do this. Sometimes, boy, we analyze and figure and make calculations and so forth and then make a decision. And sometimes, either way we do it, we make the wrong decision. At least I do. I don't know whether y'all make wrong decisions or not, but I make some wrong decisions sometimes. And so, you know, how do we manage making good decisions? And science has said is we really need to be thinking more probabilistically in the way that we make decisions. You know, what factors, for example, were important in your decision to marry your spouse? That was a pretty big decision, wasn't it? Those of you who have gotten married, and those of you who have not gotten married, maybe you can learn a little bit about this in choosing your future spouse. You know, so many things like that, we don't tend to be very analytical. At least I wasn't. I don't know about y'all, but, you know, things like that, you know, we can, let me flash up a list here of some of the factors that might go into making a decision on whether to marry an individual. For example, you might say, well, do we think alike? Or have the same interest? Or desire to produce children who are smart or athletic or artistic or whatever is important to you? Or income potential? Or physical appeal? Or similar values? Or similar religious beliefs? Or complementary personality? Or sense of humor? Or the big one, love? Now, that's not a complete list. I've listed about 10 things here, in fact, just to get you thinking about this. Now, I'm sure all of you wise old married couples, when you were getting married, I'm sure you developed a list like this and really thought about things like, do we think alike, for example? Or do we have the same interests? And you went through this list and you thought about all these things and you analyzed it and came up with the decision, yes, I want to marry that individual, right? Is that the way it worked? Well, it didn't work that way with me. You know, I may have considered a couple of these things, but I didn't really get into and I'm an engineer, and I like to analyze things and put numbers on things, but I didn't really get into that kind of approach when I asked my wife of nearly 55 years now to marry me. Now, mine seemed to have worked out okay without doing that, but at the same time, when you look at something like this, what does this kind of list remind you of? When I was put it together and thought about it, it kind of reminds me of a list that parents in other cultures who basically select the spouse of their children might put together and might analyze, rather than what the individuals themselves might put together and analyze in making a huge decision in your life of who you're going to marry. And I have a feeling that not many people do that these days. As a matter of fact, I looked up some statistics, and the last I found was in 2015. There were 2015, there were 32.2 marriages per 1,000 women, but there were 16.9 divorces per 1,000 women. So people were only getting married about twice as fast as they were getting divorced per 1,000 women. So it looks like that the current approach that's being used is not working too well. Now, if we think about it, there was an interesting set of studies that were conducted back in 2011. And in these studies, the intelligence services of the federal government wanted to study how to improve intelligence forecasting. And so what they did was they gave grants to about a dozen universities around the country to study this issue and come up with some recommendations on how to improve intelligence forecasting. Now, most of the universities used about the same approach. They said, well, let's just take a random sampling of people. and let's have them make forecasts, and then the ones that were most accurate in their forecasts, let's see if we can figure out what they did differently from those who did not have were not very accurate in making forecasts. And those studies gave some information, but didn't really lead anywhere. But there were a couple of universities who took a different approach, and they said, let's see if we can train people to be better forecasters. Can we train people to be better forecasters? So they took that approach and looked for ways they could teach people how to improve forecasting. And part of this was thinking probabilistically. A lot of people don't think that way in general. And some of the things that they came up with is, first of all, some people are more skilled than others at envisioning various futures. Some people have developed that through their own experiences or whatever and are pretty good at it. But they also found out that learning how to make better decisions required developing a comfort with doubt. You have to recognize when you make a decision, it's not 100% that that's going to be the best decision, the right choice that you make. You have to accept there's always some doubt, and you should be thinking in terms of how much doubt. And maybe you shouldn't make the decision you're making if there's too much doubt. Another thing that they came up with is the future isn't one thing but a multitude of possibilities that often contradict one another until one of them happens. And so we just, a lot of our decisions, our choices, we're like selecting a spouse, very complex. A lot of factors really go into whether there's going to be the choice that's going to result in a successful marriage. Now, another point that they came up with is envision a future event as an array of potential variables with different probabilities of occurring. Now, you're looking at something in the future you want to predict. Well, there's all these variables, and there's different probabilities. The likelihood of A happening versus the likelihood of B coming true depends on a lot of different variables, but maybe it's much higher probability that A will occur than B will occur. So you have to kind of look at things from that perspective and then make an estimate based on probabilities. Now, so that's kind of one thing that science says, is that we need to be thinking in those terms. But let's go back to our list here. Let's go back to our list for a minute and think about, well, how, suppose this was the list. You know, this is a list, but suppose it was the list. And you say, okay, I'm gonna look at this thing, and you know, usually when we think in terms of probabilities, we like to put some numbers on it. Is there a 50% chance of something happen? Is it a 70% chance? So forth. And that's convenient to do with a scale of 1 to 10. But you can say, okay, like this first one, think alike. You might say, okay, how much do we think alike? And put a number from 1 to 10, which would basically be a percentage of occasions that you think alike. Now, that's something you might be able to kind of pin down. You know, I think about in selecting my wife, I didn't really think about how much we think alike, but looking back at that time, you know, we didn't think exactly alike. You know, I thought like an engineer. She thought like an artiste. You know, so we thought differently in many respects. So, yeah, if I was putting a percentage on how much we think alike, I might say, well, that'd be 50%. You know, I might say a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10 is the way we think alike. You know, I have the same interest. We had a lot of the same interest. I might have, you know, put an 8 or a 9, maybe a 7, because we had a fair amount of the same interest, but there was some differences in our interest. Sports. Yeah, you know, in high school, and I met my wife in high school, you know, I played basketball, I played football, I ran track, I was really into sports. And Not long after I'd met her, and I was playing varsity football, but a friend of mine was playing on the JV team. And one of my first dates with my wife was to take her to this JV football team to see my friend play. And like I say, we hadn't been dating very long, and to my absolute shock, to my astonishment, she knew absolutely nothing about football. And so I had to start from scratch explaining, they got to go from this end to this end. Well, how come they're punting the ball? Why don't they keep going? And just all the fundamentals had to start from zero because, she hadn't been interested in football. We had a lot of the same interests, but sports was kind of iffy there. So I might have got a 7 or 8 on that, as we go down the line here of different things. Now, I gave very, very little thought to what kind of children we might produce or, income potential. Never thought much about that. Some of these things I thought about a little bit, physical appeal and love. Love. I was in love. And so she gets a great big 10 because I was in love. But now, if you're thinking in probabilistic terms, you might go through a list that you might compose like this and say, okay, I'm going to put down numbers, 1 to 10, 1 to 10. 5 on this one, 7 on that one, 10 on that one, 8 on that one. And maybe add up the numbers. Now, this list is 10. So if everything was perfect, then you come up with 100. Now, if you made a list like this and only came up with 30, you might want to rethink a few things before you get married. But see, that's thinking probabilistically. You're looking at some information and you're thinking, well, how is this really going to work? You may not be projecting ahead 55 years. I certainly didn't project that 55 years from now, after being married to her for almost 55 years, that I'd still be alive even, much less standing up giving sermons. But, maybe thinking 10 years in the future. How's it going to be 10 years in the future? Our marriages don't last 10 years. And so, you have to get into that kind of thinking sometimes to make good choices. Now, one of the problems with that kind of thinking is that it's very difficult to put numbers on certain things. Even something like this, putting a number on how much you think alike, that's not easy to do. And there's no guarantee that just because you think exactly alike that your marriage will be perfect. But it's probabilities. It's more probable if you think a lot alike that your marriage would be more successful than if you completely opposite in the way you thought, see? And all these things. All right, but let's go on a little further. And related to that is understanding data. Understanding data, when you think about it, we have access to more data than ever existed in the history of the world. Our phones count our steps. Websites track our spending. Digital maps guide us. Apps manage our schedules. Measure our calories, check our heartbeats when we work out. We got all this data, and it can overwhelm us. So how do you deal with all this data? Data coming at us from all directions constantly, and it seems we weren't quite designed to handle so much data. Now, a few years ago, there was a Columbia University study, and this was a massive study. But what they were studying was, why don't more people sign up for IRAs, retirement accounts, which most companies offer these days. And they studied 800,000 people across over 100 companies. And, you know, the thinking was, well, generally it should be a no-brainer to sign up for IRAs, because one big thing is you get free money, because the employer usually kicks in some money, you know, matches what you put in, at least to a certain extent, and in many cases, most cases that they were looking at, that was true. So you're getting some free money for later on. Plus, that money is not taxable now, and so you're saving money now, and so eventually you're going to have to pay some tax. It may not be as high a tax rate. You'll be in a better position to pay taxes if the rates haven't changed. And so it just seems kind of a no-brainer to invest in IRAs from your company. But what they did is they started studying how people were currently doing it. And what they found was that on companies that offered two different plans, 75% enrolled. Companies that offered 25 plans, a little less enrolled, 72%. But companies that offered 39 plans, only 65% enrolled. And companies that offered 60 plans, only 53% enrolled. In other words, the more plans that were offered, the less the number of employees enrolled in those plans. Why is that? What's going on here? Well, they were studying this, and they had some conclusions related to this. And, you know, basically what they were saying, or what they concluded was, is information overload. With 60 plans, how do you sort out 60 plans? And so, no, I just give up. I won't invest in them. You know, that sort of thing. And they, matter of fact, they came up with kind of a magic number of around 30 plans. If you have more than 30 plans, participation is going to go down significantly. Less than 30 plans, it stays up around 75% or so, 70 to 75%. Yeah, so, people have trouble. If you have to make a decision among 60 choices, you may give up, whereas you're only making a decision between two choices. Yeah, it's pretty easy. Yeah, this one or that one. You know, what's going on here? We have more information, but we do not understand how to use it. Information blindness is one problem. The inability to take advantage of data as it becomes more plentiful. We just get kind of blinded by all the data, and we can't take advantage of it. Another problem, and so how do you solve this problem of information overload? Well, one way is what experts refer to as winnowing, which is to break the data down into a series of smaller and smaller pieces. And if you're going to try to choose between 60 plans, don't say, I got to choose between 60 plans. Maybe group them in groups of five. Say, okay, which is the best of this group? Pick that one, and then keep winnowing it down till finally you've got it down to two or three or four, something you can manage. But, you know, you make much more efficient in making choices if you can narrow down the databases and deal with pieces at a time. And that's been proven to be very successful. Now, basically, winnowing is how our brains turn information into knowledge. You know, think about how much information, since you walked in these doors, how much information you've been hit with. How many conversations have you had? And how many of you can repeat or can name every single person you talked to since you walked in the door? Can even name the people that you've talked to? Much less say, okay, here's what this person said. Here's what this person said. Here's what, you know. There's so much information coming at us all the time. So how do we deal with that? You know, well, winnowing is one way, and the brain kind of does that naturally. You know, you meet people, you talk about this. Well, maybe that's not interesting, but something else really is in. That kind of stays in your mind. And so you do exactly that. Now, Let's turn this away from companies and corporations and begin talking spiritually here for a minute along these lines, because we've been being bombarded with spiritual data also. You know, just take our church. How many articles are available to you through Life Open Truth? Anybody counted them up? Last I heard, there was something like 700 or so articles on Life Open Truth, and that's been a while, so it's probably grown since then. You know, the Discern magazines. How many sermons are online that are available to you? Ever looked? You know, there must be, I didn't count them up, I don't know, 20 or 30 local church websites that post their sermons. How many sermons are available on our website? Anybody know? I don't. But there's a bunch there. And on other websites, there's bunches, you know, church websites. Now, I'm not talking about all the other things on the internet. But think of all that information. Suppose you took as a task, well, I'm going to go to every church that has a website that has sermons, and I'm going to listen to all the sermons that are on there. How long do you think it'd take you to do that? A long time. A very long time. But let's take one example. Anybody have any anger issues? Anybody ever get mad when they shouldn't? Yeah, probably not. But, you know, sometimes I have some anger issues. But, you know, if you have anger issues, what do you do? Where do you go? Well, you could go to Life, Hope, and Truth, for example. And if you did, and I did, you know, if you say, well, what does the Bible say about anger? Well, the way we used to do it in the old days, before the internet, and before all these phones with a whole Bible in our cell phone and that sort of thing. How did we do it? We went to the good old concordance, didn't we? Big, thick concordance. Okay, look up anger. Everywhere where scripture on anger appears. And we start going through. Then from the book, okay, now let's find it in the Bible. And we go through, and boy, there's 825 times that anger has been mentioned in the Bible. So in the course of maybe 2 years, you might wade your way through those and read every one and study it and put them together and organize. You know, that's kind of the way you had to deal with it, but not so anymore. You know, first, electronically, you can not just have to go from one written word to another written word to tie it together. It just pops up. You know, type in anger, and it gives you the scripture. You tap on that, and the scripture passage pops up and so forth. So it's a lot easier to do. But then we have things like, excuse me, Life, Hope, and Truth. And so that's what I did. I looked up anger on the search engine that's a part of Life, Hope, and Truth, just to see what came up. Not that I have any anger issues, but just to see what came up. And what came up first was overcoming anger. And it was three articles, part one, two, and three. You'd think I wrote it, part one, two, and three. But it, you know, so this three-part article came up. Then an article entitled Anger Can Lead to Sin. And then the next article was Fighting the Works of the Flesh, Outbursts of Wrath. And then one came up, Three Ways to Deal with Road Rage in Life. And then another one came up next, How to Overcome Jealousy. Then Two Keys to Peace with Others. And Jesus Christ Taught Peace and Nonviolence. And this was just on that first page. So there's a lot more there. But that's enough to get somebody started if they really want to look at, well, I've got some anger issues and I need to address it. And where do I start? Well, there's a good place. But you see what's happening. What's the search engine do? It's winnowing. It's winnowing down the data for you. And one way search engines winnow data down is they keep track of how many people have hit that article. And if a lot of people are hitting that article, the search engine will place that up higher on the list because it's a popular article. So that's one way that the primary way that search engines sort these things out. So it's not perfect, but it's better than what we had 30, 40 years ago. So I want to get into something else, and this is was surprising to me when I was reading about this, and that's the role of emotion in choices. What is the role of emotion in choices? Should there be any room for emotion when you make a choice? Or should it be completely and totally analytical, as best you can? Set the emotion aside. Let's make a rational decision. Isn't that the way it should be? Well, interestingly enough, it turns out that science does not believe that that's the way it should be. I read this in relation to this. There was this story about a man named Elliot. And Elliot was a very successful businessman, very successful, rich businessman. Matter of fact, he was known in and most of his business were located in Louisiana. He went on a vacation trip overseas. And when he came back, he had changed. You know, he was a very aggressive businessman, had a number of companies and so forth, made a lot of money. And he came back, and he had changed. And the problem was he had no emotions. He was emotionless. And so he appeared intelligent. There seemed to me no deficits in his in the conventional cognitive test that you do about mental capacity. Didn't seem to have any deficits in any way in the normal test you might conduct to see if there is something wrong with the brain, what's going on here. But he couldn't experience emotions. He was always dispassionate. He was like kind of an uninvolved spectator to life. It was a strange thing. He had no sense of his own suffering because of it. There was no impatience, no frustration in his life, no emotions. You know, now, you think, who does that sound like? Who does that sound like if you have no emotions? Well, all the Star Trek fans know exactly who it sounds like. It sounds like Spock, right? Spock in the Star Trek series. You know, he was half human, half Vulcan. And Vulcans had, through, quote, evolution, the Vulcans had evolved to where they can totally suppress their emotions. And they had no emotions. They were totally and completely rational and logical. Spock, being half Vulcan, half human, had a little more problem suppressing his emotions, so he was doing a pretty good job of it. You know, so and so that's always been portrayed in science fiction as kind of like the ideal situation. Emotions get in the way. And if you can be totally and perfectly logical, and certainly that's the way Spock was portrayed, then, man, you know, Spock saves the day because of his logic. Everybody else is emotional, Kirk going crazy, and all kinds of things are happening. And logical Spock is right there, you know, staying calm and doing the right calculations on this computers and coming up with solutions. Well, that's the way this guy was. Now, doctors had worked with him trying to figure out what's going on because there was real concern for the guy. Because of these problems, and what they did brain scans and all this kind of stuff, and in one of the brain scans, they did find that at a certain location in the brain where there's a little teeny small hemorrhage of a blood vessel, so small that almost didn't detect it. It's the kind of things that the doctors were used to seeing in brain scans, but they didn't affect anything. And what they found, I like to look at brains, don't you? Yeah. What they found is this area right here, the orbital frontal cortex, which is right behind the eyebrows, that bone right there at the eyebrows. It's called the OFC, the orbital frontal cortex, the OFC. What they found is that's where the hemorrhage occurred, in that area. Now, there was one other, so here he was, completely and totally rational. But I haven't mentioned the one other problem he did have. The other problem that he had is he couldn't make decisions. Couldn't make decisions. Now, everything just went on forever. See, so he was completely rational and no emotions. And so he's looking at this and looking at that. One of the doctors described the difficulty in trying to set up an appointment with him over the phone. Simple thing. When do you want to come in for your next appointment? He couldn't decide. But he wasn't frustrated. He wasn't upset. But he was going through, well, let's see. Is it going to be better in the morning or the afternoon? What day of the week is the best day? When is sunrise? When is sunset? When is this? When is that? You know, and he'd spend a half hour to an hour on the phone trying to get this individual simply to make a decision about when to come into his office. You know, that's the problem. And so this struck this doctor that was trying to figure out what was wrong with him. And he started going back and seeing if he could find some similar cases. And he did. He found some other people that had gone through the same experience. And when they looked at the x-rays of those, or the MRIs of those individuals, they saw the same thing. There was some kind of damage in the OFC. The orbitofrontal cortex. And so this astounded scientists, because you think if you can get the emotions out of it, you can make decisions, better decisions, more quickly, more efficiently. And without this emotion as part of the brain, he couldn't make any decisions. And so this is pretty shocking and this particular individual, it could be a tumor, it could be a ruptured blood, hemorrhaging blood vessel, it could be all kinds of things. But, that's how it happens. If that particular area is damaged, then you have no emotions and you can't make decisions. Which is kind of fascinating. Now, I think I've probably shown this something similar to this to you before. Now, scientists have now identified like 300 or so areas of the brain where certain things happen. The brain is always firing. Now, they measure this by electrical firings of the neurons in the brain, and measuring the intensity of these firings. And our brain is always firing, but then when something happens, if you're afraid, a certain part of the brain just spikes from the firings. Or if you see something, you're admiring a beautiful sunset, another part of the brain fires up, spikes, And they've identified hundreds of these areas like this, including the OFC, where it seems to be where primarily the seat of emotions is. Now, all these things overlap to some extent, but in this particular case, it's the OFC that is particularly important, and damaging it can result in not only no emotions, but you can't make decisions. Now, the conventional view of human nature, down through, going back all the way back to the ancient Greeks, the conventional view of human nature has been that the perfect man would be one who does make decisions devoid of emotions. You know, it's viewed from an evolutionary perspective that man evolved. And down through the ages, especially since evolutionary theory, we're going all the way back to the Greeks, they kind of felt like the emotions get in the way, get rid of the emotions and be logical, and that's the perfect man kind of thing. But once Darwin got in the picture, they began to look at things a little bit differently. And the view has been that the brain stem was the first part to evolve, is what the conventional view has been. That evolution of humans, the brain stem came first, and that governs the most basic bodily functions. You know, I'll put up a slide of the brain there. You know, the brain stem is right down here in that area. And, you know, that governs things like heartbeat, breathing, body temperature, you know, basic things like that. And then the belief is, according to evolutionary theory, that then later on came the diencephalon, which regulates things like hunger pangs, sleep, cycles, you know, things of that nature. And that kind of formed kind of around, you know, we're looking at two-dimensional, but it kind of formed on top of and around the brain stem as the brain gradually evolved. And then, you know, so we're talking about this area right in here, right on top of the brain stem. They believe that's what came next. And then the limbic region, which generates animal emotions, you know, the lust, violence, impulsive behavior, that sort of thing. And that's kind of now covering, you know, surrounding those more primitive parts of the brain. Now you get up to the limbic system. And these three layers are shared by all the mammals. All have those. But then comes the big one, the frontal cortex, you know, which is responsible for reason, intellect, morality, thinking, all those kinds of things. You know, this whole area up here, you know, where the OFC was a part of it, is part of that. But that's where the action takes place in thinking. And that makes us unique from the animals because of that particular part of the brain. Now, the idea down through the ages has been, well, if we can suppress our emotions, we'll be better people. Now, our emotions just are bad. You know, kind of, emotions bad, rational intellect good. We need more Spocks and less Kirks in the world, kind of thing. But what this discovery has shown is that it's just the opposite. That without emotions, you can't make decisions. Which shocked the scientists when they saw this. And, of course, it does present a pretty big problem for the theory of evolution. If you need them both, which, you know, it's the old chicken and the egg kind of thing. Which came first? Well, it's the same thing here. Which came first? Rational mind or the emotional part of the mind? Well, they're all together there in the same part. So, and you need both. Now, let's get back to the orbitofrontal cortex, the OFC. You know, that's where conscious reasoning, decision-making, it requires emotion. And now we're getting something I've talked about before in sermons, and I'll mention it just briefly here. You know, if you need rational thinking and you need emotions, that might sound like something you might recall from some sermons I've given in the past in regard to the intuitive versus the analytical parts of our brain. Remember that discussion? You know, a significant part of the frontal cortex is involved in emotion. The OFC integrates the visceral emotions into decision-making process. It's an integrating part of the brain. The OFC connects feelings generated by the intuitive system of the brain to the stream of conscious thought in the analytical system. You know, so we have this intuitive system where things just happen. We don't even think about them. You know, the subconscious versus the conscious is another way of looking at it. But we need them both. And the emotions are located in that intuitive part of the brain. Then we have our analytical conscious part of the brain. And just as a refresher, the intuitive system can be thought of as thinking fast. You know, it's recognizing the angry man. It's impulsive. You suddenly orient to a sudden sound. Somebody made a loud noise in the back of the room. Everybody would look before they thought, hey, I hear a noise. I think I'll look. No, you just look. You know, it takes over in emergencies. It completes the phrase bread and, you know, I would say butter. Some would say jam, but something popped into your mind. Or 3 plus 3. Nobody, I don't think, said, well, let's see, 3 plus 3. And 1, 2, 3. I got 3 fingers here, and I got, you know, 3 fingers here. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, yeah, 6. Nobody does that. Intuitively, you know the answer to something like that, or what the capital of France is. You know, those kind of, they just pop into your mind immediately, as opposed to our analytical system, which is slower thinking, calculated thinking. It requires attention and is disrupted when attention is drawn away. It's mental work. It's deliberate and requires effort. It's the answer to 21 times 38. Few people can do that in their heads. Most people have to think about it, maybe write it down and multiply it out. I don't know what the answer to that is without writing it out. But things like counting the occurrence of a letter, like the letter A in a paragraph. You have to do it pretty carefully, you'll make a mistake, you know, that sort of thing. You know, so we have these two systems, the analytical system, the logical system, which we think of as the decision-making system, and then the intuitive system, part of the brain, which is where the emotions play a role, and it plays a role in decision-making. So, you know, and think about it. As children mature, they change, and their intuitive system and their analytical system begins a trade-off. Everything is analytical at the beginning, pretty much. But as they grow, things get shifted down into the intuitive area. You know, like learning how to walk, for example. You know, first time they take a step, the kid falls down. And it gets up. But pretty soon, they're running around and not even thinking about it. It's now become a part of the intuitive system. But initially, it's part of the analytical system. So, you know, the intuitive system can be modified through experience and training. Our emotions are part of that intuitive system. They can be modified through experience and training. Proverbs 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That process is moving things from the analytical part of the mind down into the intuitive part, where it lives and stays. As I said, there are a lot of, you know, by adulthood, we've developed a lot of strengths and weaknesses, and our analytical mind is in pretty good shape in terms of its capacity. Our intuitive part of our mind is also in pretty good shape. But maybe not such a good shape if the things that it's been being taught are not good. Now, that's the problem, as we see in 2 Peter 2, verse 14. Having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, they have a heart trained in covetous practices and are cursed children. They've been trained in covetous practice, or they've been badly trained. And so what gets down into that intuitive system is bad things rather than good things. And so you can go either way there. Now, Paul felt this, wrestled with this. It's a long passage, but I'm just quoting one verse here in Romans 7 and verse 14, where he wrote, "For what I am doing," meaning intuitively, "I do not understand. For what I will to do," the analytical mind, "that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do." So he's wrestling with these two parts of his mind, the analytical part, the intuitive part, the part where the emotions dwell. Okay, I guess you're wondering how I was going to finally get to some scriptures. Well, here we are. The first one thing I want to look at here, of several instances of people making choices as it relates to the role of emotions in choices that we make. First one is Stephen. Let's look at Stephen here. And his famous sermon that's described in Acts chapter 7. We want to pick it up in verse 51 here. "You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in the heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do you." You know, so he's giving this sermon, and he's just firing away at these Jews, and they, obviously there was a bunch of religious leaders there listening to that. Now, where was he speaking? Was he speaking from his analytical brain? Yes. But was he also speaking from his emotional part of his brain? Obviously, he was fired up. He was emotional. But he had been trained in the emotions. And he made a choice that he was going to lay it on the line to all these people. "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the just one, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers." He's getting pretty strong here, calling them murderers. "Who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. When they heard these things, they were cut," my margin says furious, "to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth." Now, so here we find Stephen. Obviously, and as we read on here, obviously he had God's Spirit. He had God's Spirit. He was inspired. And so he was using his emotions, he was using his analytical mind, and he made a choice to lay it on the hard on these individuals listening to him at that particular time. Now, let's continue on here in verse 55 of Acts 7. "But he, being full of the Holy Spirit," so he definitely had God's Spirit, "gazed into the heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God and said, 'Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God.'" Now think about that. Very few people in the history of the world have seen a vision like that. Very few. Stephen did. You know, Christ made himself visible to Stephen at that particular crisis moment. You know. Now, of course, you know, we know what's happening here. The Stephen is risking his life. Christ, you know what Christ said, "Greater love has no man than to lay down his life for a friend." You know, he was on the verge of getting stoned and was stoned, as you well aware of. but why? At this point, God appears in the vision. He sees it. Not clear that anybody else saw it. Probably not. Why didn't God protect him? Why didn't God protect him? You ever thought about that? He sees him. You know, we can only speculate. It's not clear why God allowed the stoning to take place. But could it be that he was so full of the Holy Spirit that he was simply ready? That he was there. He had fought the good fight and was where he needed to be to be at rest until the resurrection. You know, that's certainly a possibility and a pretty, you might say, a probability that he had reached that point in his spiritual growth that he was ready to die and wait for Christ's return. But could there have been another purpose? Let's read on in verse 58 of Acts 7. And they cast him out of the city and stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. And they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God. And so here, you know, they've taken off some garments so they could stone him better. They laid him down right at the feet. So Paul was there. Paul was a part of all this. What did Paul see? What did Paul see that day? Well, he saw a man having a vision. He may not have seen the vision, but he saw the man was seeing something and looking up into the sky. He saw a man that was willing to die for his beliefs. A man willing to die for his beliefs. And then he saw something else. Continue on here. Then as he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." And when he had said this, he fell asleep, or he died. And so he saw a man asking God to forgive his own murderers as he was dying. And so I raised the question, it's purely speculation. Could part of the reason that God allowed Stephen to sacrifice his life was for Paul? Did it take that much to begin the conversion process of Paul? It took a lot because God had to strike him down. You know the story of Paul being blinded. But was this the first step? And did Paul need this as a starting point? You know, we don't know. We can only speculate. But see, choices were made here. Choices were made by Stephen. It cost him his life. Choices were made by that crowd. Both were fueled by emotions. Stephen's emotions were inspired. The crowd's emotions were demonic, murderous of their father, Satan, the devil. See, so both happen and both lead to decisions, some good and some bad. So you need God's Spirit to make the kind of decisions that are right and good. Another example that I find interesting is in 1 Samuel 20, beginning in verse 30 through 33 here. It involves Saul and Jonathan and David. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, his son, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" And again, I can only speculate here, but my guess is that this is not an exactly a word-for-word translation of what Saul said. I kind of suspect it was coarser, and it was cleaned up to put into the Bible. That's just my suspicion. But it's pretty strong words here, and it was probably even stronger and coarser in the exact words that he used. But anyway, continue on here. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom." So he said, look, you're the heir to the throne. Don't you get it? "Now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." He said, get with the program. You want to be king after me? We got to kill David. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said, let's go at it. I'll set him up. Just the opposite, didn't it? Jonathan answered his father and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Then Saul cast a spear at him, his own son, to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. You're going to kill us. Now, you know, the Bible describes this close relationship of Jonathan and David. You know, they were extremely close. They were like brothers. Very close. Jonathan made a decision here to side with David as opposed to his own father. You know, that's how strong that relationship was. That was a choice Jonathan made. Now, of course, a little bit later on, Jonathan was in a battle with Saul's army and was killed. But he had made that choice as far as David was concerned. I want to say a little bit more about that in just a minute. But I want to end up with Ruth. Ruth's decision. You know, the Bible, the book of Ruth, is usually read by the Jews on Pentecost or around Pentecost time. But I want to just look at, I want to focus here on the decision that Ruth made. The decision, the choice that she had. Just with a little background here in Ruth 1, verses 1 and 2. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. Why was there a famine in the land? This is the time of the judges. What did God say back in those days? You obey me, you'll be blessed. You disobey me, you'll be cursed. Obviously, a famine is a curse. So this was one of those times when Israel kind of went down in terms of their attitude towards God. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. That must have been pretty bad. They had left, leave the country. And think about it. It was so bad that they had to go to Moab of all places because it was better in Moab than it was in Israel at the time. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. You know, so here they are. They're from Bethlehem. They had two sons. We go on, and in verse 4, we see that, I won't show that here, but in verse 4, they lived there about 10 years, and their two sons married Moabite women. Not the best idea in general. God generally condemned that. But they both, in verse 4, it says that they married Moabite women. And then in verse 5, both the sons died. And then Naomi heard, and this begins verse 6, so we'll pick up there in Ruth 1, verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-laws that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. So obviously Israel had turned, God lifted the famine, and so she's ready to go back. She lost her husband. She had lost her two married sons. She was there with her two daughter-in-laws. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So they started out, and then Naomi stopped and thought. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-laws, go, return each to your mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. All right, so, you know, both these women honored Naomi to the point that they were going with her, leaving their own country, heading into Israel. But Naomi had second thoughts here. She stopped, said, no, you're making a bad choice. You shouldn't do this. You know, so beginning in verse 9 then of Ruth 1, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in his house of her husband. So she kissed them, and they lifted their voices and wept. And they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? So see, Naomi is telling them what choice to make here. Stay in Moab. Go back to your families. With some good luck, you'll probably find a husband and you'll have children and everything will be great. That's what you need to go. And then she emphasizes that here. And says, and there's are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them until they were grown? She painted a pretty bad picture of life as a spinsterhood for these two women in Israel. But then it didn't stop there in verse 13. Would you restrain yourself from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Ah. Now we see the state that Naomi was in. The hand of God had gone against her. Naomi was down. She was troubled. She saw God as having gone against her, not just having not intervened, but gone against her. You know, so she was in bad state. She was going downhill fast in the state she was in. It's the best way to describe it. So then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her, and she said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. So here again, one last time, go back, go back. One did, Ruth didn't. How did she make that choice? You know, Naomi's argument was, number one, the culture at that time was pretty much man-centric. A woman was nothing without a husband. So she needed to get back to her family because it's likely she would find a husband in Moab. She goes into Israel. Israel had turned back to God. It's more unlikely that she's going to find a husband in Israel. You know, so that was part of it. And, you know, by herself, who's going to take care of her? And then the other argument was that God is against me. You don't want to be associated with me because God is punishing me. That's basically her argument. One left and the other stayed. And then in verse 16, Ruth made her decision. One of the most inspiring, beautiful quotes in all the Bible. But Ruth said, entreat me now not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. The Lord God do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you from me. That's commitment. That is commitment. How did Ruth come to make that decision? What was Ruth thinking? Was this just an emotional reaction? Or was there a component of analysis and emotions that went into this huge decision? Let's look at the things. We can only speculate about what went on in Ruth's mind. But let's look at the aspects of the choices that she was making. For example, my family or Naomi? Yeah, that's a pretty tough choice. Do I go to my mother or to my mother-in-law? You know, in today's society, people say, that's crazy. Who's going to go with their mother-in-law? That's today's society. But she made the choice to go with Naomi. She saw something in Naomi that she didn't see in her own mother and family. Another part of that choice might have been, think of Naomi's needs or think of my own needs. Naomi was in a very bad place, and Ruth knew it. And so now she could think of her own needs. Yeah, boy, that sounds bad. I don't want to be a spinster. I want a family. I want children. I want to be taken care of. But then there was Naomi's needs. So she was giving up her needs for Naomi's needs. Now, Boaz referred to this a little bit later on. Let's just cut into Ruth 2, verse 11 here. Boaz said this, "It has been fully reported to me all you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband." Naomi told everybody, and they saw how Ruth was taking care of a depressed, desperate woman who felt like God was after her at that stage. And then, part of that decision, the God of Israel, the gods of Moab. You know, Ruth had an interesting perspective because she was reared in the system of the gods of Moab. And those were not nice gods. They didn't do nice things to serve those gods. But then during her marriage, she was exposed to the God of Israel for the first time. Saw something completely different. Completely different. The God of Israel or the God of Moab? She chose the God of Israel. Related to that, refuge under God or refuge under people. Yeah, she could take refuge in her family. She could take refuge under her people. But all she had, Naomi wasn't going to take care of her. Naomi was a wreck. So all she had if she went with Naomi was refuge under God. Boaz recognized this in Ruth 2:12. Boaz said, "The Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." He recognized that. And then there was the character of Ruth. Virtuous or virtueless? You know, that kind of sums it all up. Virtuous or virtueless? Again, Boaz. In Ruth 3:11, "For all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman." Her reputation was visible to all. You know, we can only speculate on how much Ruth thought about these choices and weighed these various things, but likely she did. But you know, I said that this, the Jewish tradition to read the book of Ruth at Pentecost. It's also a tradition that the Ten Commandments were given on Pentecost. It was around Pentecost when Ruth met Boaz, you know, the barley harvest, the early harvest, and the wheat harvest, the later harvest. So it was during that period of time that all this was going on. You know, Ruth coming out of Moab to accept God's ways could be compared to Israel coming out of Egypt. Ruth being given the opportunity to be part of Israel is analogous to today's opportunity to receive God's Spirit, as pictured by Pentecost. You know, so we have all these kinds of things. But there's something else here. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 11. "For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of man that is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God." Now, we can make decisions on our own. God gave us a mind. He gave us the ability to make and good decisions. We can make good decisions without God's Spirit. Outside of God, we can make good decisions. We can also make some pretty bad decisions. But we have the capability of making good decisions simply through the spirit of man, the way God created us. But unless we have God's Spirit, you know, we're not going to make godly decisions. We've got to have God's Spirit if we're going to make godly decisions. And what is the most godly of all decisions? If you had to say, what, if I'm going to make any decision, what is the most godly of decisions? I suggest this, found in 1 John 4, verse 16. And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love. And he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. You know, godly love. That's the biggest decision we will make in this life, to have godly love towards one another. You know, Ruth exhibited that godly love. Jonathan and David, that relationship. Obviously, David had godly love, a man after God's own heart. But what about Jonathan? He ended up sacrificing his life in war. Was God's Spirit guiding Jonathan to protect David? Probably so. What about Stephen? Choosing to preach the truth in spite of the risk of death. Made choices. They each made choices. Sometimes it costs you your life. Deuteronomy 30, verses 19 and 20. God speaking to those ancient Israelites. He said, I call heaven and earth as witness today against you that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Lord has sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to them. You know, our choices can be pretty good on their own, but they're great when they're fueled by the Holy Spirit. That's when we make great choices. You know, we read this. God kind of fulfilled this to Ruth, didn't he? And you know what happened? World history changed through the actions of Ruth. Because Ruth ended up marrying Boaz. And in Ruth 4 and verse 21 and 22... Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. The great-grandmother of David was Ruth. You know, the choices you make now, guided by God's Spirit, using both your analytical and the emotional part of your mind, will decide your influence or your future, but it will also likely influence others down the line. You think Ruth ever imagined that her great-grandson would be king of Israel? Probably not. She wasn't thinking about that, but she made some choices. Surely, God was guiding her as she made those choices. God's Spirit must have been guiding her. So I'll leave you with this question. Will history be changed by you because of the choices you make?